This is Digital Story Podcast number 1064, August 11th, 2026. Today's theme is A Conversation About Lightroom. I'm Derek Story. Having just completed two workshops with lots of lab work, I thought it'd be a great idea to compare notes with Lightroom expert Rob Knight about the evolution of the software, how we can use those changes to improve our workflows, and how advanced techniques mean less work in front of the computer, not more. All of that on this week's TDS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. Rob and I were working together in lab in Costa Rica, and we had 10 photographers in there with their laptops open, working diligently on their images. So we got to see a lot about their process. And then right after that, I had the Sonoma County Hot Air Balloon Festival workshop, where again, we had photographers, laptops open in lab, working in Lightroom, trying to perfect those beautiful shots that they had taken. And our observations, we were comparing notes about them, and we decided to have a conversation about Lightroom, its changes, what's new, Rob's upcoming workshop intensive, all that good stuff. I think you will enjoy this immensely. There's lots of great tips, lots of great ideas to improve your workflow just by listening to this podcast. So let's get this show on the road, and here's Rob and I talking about Lightroom. Hey, Rob, how are you doing today?
I'm great, Derek. How are you, man?
I'm really good. I'm feeling great. I'm excited to be talking about Lightroom today. I think mainly because, especially I've been noticing during the workshops and everything, just how this thing is cooking along these days.
It really is. And I'm with you. I think I'm trying to think of a workshop participant this year who wasn't using Lightroom. I think we've had one, maybe.
Yeah, I think we had one in Costa Rica, and that is not counting me.
Right.
Obviously I do use it. It's just not my number one. It's not my main thing, but I do use it. And I'm finding myself, because of the tools in it, that I'm using it more and more. I'm using Lightroom more these days than I ever have, mainly because the tools are just so crazy awesome. And feels like every time I turn around, they've introduced something new.
They really have been hitting it hard the last couple of years, especially with improvements. I mean, from performance improvements to, like you said, the tool set. I've used it since before it came out, and I'm just delighted with it. I feel like every new tool that they've introduced over the last few years has immediately become part of my workflow for every picture, that's crazy, because I liked the program 5 years ago, and now it does things that I never even dreamed of that I obviously need.
I know, it's great. So what I wanted to do today, I mean, I think for a lot of reasons, you're the perfect guy to talk about this. You have a commercial photography business where you focus on real estate. You have your workshop photography business, where you're working more with nature, wildlife photography, things like that. Two different worlds, and yet both of those worlds are processed and managed, through Lightroom Classic. I'm guessing a lot of times using a lot of the same tools. And then on top of that, you have an online workshop coming up on September 9th. And so a lot of what we're going to talk about today is really going to be at the heart of what you're going to be doing, just like a month from now.
Yeah, it won't be long now. And it's interesting, when I have a class coming up, how I think differently about the software, because I know I'm going to be teaching it. So I'll be working, like you said, whether it's a real estate shoot that I'm working on or images from our trip to Costa Rica, I'm realizing how much overlap there is in how I use the tools and just the particular tools that I use most often. It's in the front of my brain since I'm going to be talking about that next month.
Yeah, it's interesting when you're teaching, instead of just doing it, right, you go, oh, I got to remember what this is called
right.
and where it's located.
That's exactly right.
Let's talk about some of these tools right now. Let's talk about some of the tools that are kind of top of mind for you, grabbing your attention that you're excited about.
I realized, I guess it was in Costa Rica, someone was asking me about a particular process in Lightroom, and they were asking me about global adjustments. And it occurred to me that I do so little global adjustment now with my images. And I don't know if it's a way that I shoot, or if I've just, or if the tools are just so good I don't have to. But when I'm shooting, obviously I'm trying to get the exposure exactly like I want it. Whether that's a single shot of a nature photography, or whether it's bracketed shots for real estate, I'm trying to get the picture as close to done as possible before I start editing, right? And so when it comes to global adjustments, I do little things here and there, but it's almost always one part of the image that I need to adjust, whether it's the color or the contrast or the lighting. So things like the point color tool that was added just a couple of years ago to Lightroom. It's a little eyedropper where you can click on one particular color and just adjust that color within the image, right? I use that a lot for adjusting colors. And then I can also use that within a mask, which makes it even more useful. For example, in real estate photography, I might be photographing a room where they have an incandescent bulb in a lamp next to a window. So I've got this warm light on part of the room, and then I've got this cool light coming in through the window, and I've got to balance that out. So that point color tool really helps me to select just a color and adjust that. And then I can use a mask and use that in a particular place. I can use it on a particular wall or the ceiling or whatever, in a really specific way. And something that has been added just in the last year, is called variance. And it's a control within the point color tool, so that, for example, if I have a blue sky that maybe it's a lighter blue on one side and a darker blue on the other side, maybe I've used a polarizer filter or something like that, or maybe it's just not an evenly lit sky. You can select that blue color and then adjust the variance so there's less variance within that color. So you can make that blue sky just one nice tone of blue, right? Or if there's, again, say the ceiling where the light is bouncing off of five different light sources in a real estate photo, I can click that variant, I can use the variant slider and smooth out the gradients so it doesn't seem like 17 different colors.
I really like that. First of all, point color is fantastic. I totally agree with you, and variances too. And also, Rob, I've noticed it's good for portraits with
Absolutely.
skin.
I was going to say it's also great for skin tone.
It's really good for skin tones too. I found it really helpful. And we probably should just define what we mean by global adjustments, and that we're talking about if you increase vibrance as a global adjustment, then you're doing the whole shot. So everything in the
That's right.
photo gets adjusted, as opposed to a more localized adjustment where we're just working on specific areas.
That's right. I think the easiest way to talk about it is probably with exposure. A lot of clients in the field, they say, "Oh, well, the bird is in a darker area, but the background is brighter. How do we balance the exposure?" And I usually recommend try to expose for the subject, because if the subject is as close to right as you can get it, then you can adjust the background, especially today with our modern, digital cameras with raw files that seem to have unlimited data, so you can, as long as you don't just totally blow out the highlights or totally clip the shadows, you can usually salvage the background and with the tools in Lightroom. But if you have a picture, say the bird is a little bit it is properly exposed, but the background is overexposed. Well, you're not going to do a global adjustment and darken the entire image just to fix the background, because then the bird is going to be underexposed, right? So we might select the background and then adjust the exposure there, so we can adjust the exposure separately to the subject.
Yeah, that's a great way to explain it. And this all really is pointing to the different aids they have for us with masking. Sometimes we don't even really realize we're masking in Lightroom, but I mean that's really at the heart of a lot of the stuff you're talking about, isn't it?
It really is. And more often than not, when I open an image in Lightroom, among the first things I do is start masking. Because normally, again, in the field, I've gotten the exposure as close as I can get it, as a global exposure, as just something an exposure that's going to be have all the detail that I need in the highlights and the shadows and everything in between. So I'm looking at pictures here in the background. If I have a lighthouse on the shore of Maine, right, I'm going to adjust the sky differently than I might adjust the foreground with the lighthouse and the rocks and everything, right? So I'm going to immediately go to a relatively new tool in Lightroom, which is the AI landscape masks. And then I click on that. It gives me a list of everything that it sees in the picture, from the sky to the architecture to the water, and it'll automatically make me masks for the different pieces of the image.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, really,
It's
when you think
so
about it, it's
amazing.
just so cool. I mean, I think about how much I hated masking back, we know back when, Photoshop, all that kind of stuff. And now to have the application analyze your photo, right? It analyzes all the different components in the photo. It knows probably what areas that you're interested in working with, and then gives you a mask for each of them, and then you basically pick that mask.
Right. And that's definitely an area that Adobe has been spending a lot of time refining over the last few years, because those masks get better and better and better, and to where, sometimes you have to make some adjustments here and there. But even that, I was telling you a few minutes ago that they've just added a couple of masking tools just yesterday. So now there's an edge adjustment and a feathering for masks. So now I can say, hey, adjust, select the subject so it'll pick the bird, and then I can expand or subtract or contract that mask, and then feather the edge so it looks more natural. And those are the kinds of things that yesterday I might have made a sky selection, and then sometimes maybe if the trees are not full, there's some little branches, maybe there's a little highlight, a little halo around those branches. Well, now I can expand that sky mask into the tree a little bit and feather it so it looks more natural, and it just fades into that foreground.
I want to ask you about that for a second. How often, using now these advanced masking tools that we have, how often do you find yourself having to go back and adjust the mask, or for the most part, are they what you need, just sort of, as we say, out of the box?
Especially now, they are normally pretty darn close to what I need. There was an update in February of this year that it seemed to supercharge the subject detection and the background. The beauty of it is, if the program can use AI to discover the subject, well, that means I can also click the background mask, and it makes a great mask for the background too. There's an example, back to my lighthouse example. I just happen to have it in front of me. I can use the architecture mask, and it will select the lighthouse and the little tender's cottage next door. But where the railing on the light goes around the top of the lighthouse, it also selected sort of inside the railing, right? So I have to go in and sort of adjust that maybe. That's some of the few adjustments I might have to make. Or if it's a bird in a tree, sometimes it'll get, maybe the tail feathers are on the other side of the branch. Often it'll pick up those tail feathers, sometimes it won't. It's always little refinements more than it is, well, let me go fix this mask, right?
Now, the way you've been doing that, you just go in with a brush and clean that up a little bit.
It really depends, because the way the masking works in Lightroom, I can use any of the masking tools to add or subtract. So the object selection, which has also improved. If I'm missing a feather or a foot or something like that, I'll just use the object detection and select the object and let Lightroom help me.
Good.
Because a lot of times, especially with wildlife, the animal might be the same color as the background, and it might not be a hard edge that's easy for Lightroom to see, but then that object detection will often pick that up in a way that a brush by itself won't do.
Wow, that's really nice. I know one of the little tools that I use, because I shoot Micro Four Thirds a lot, and sometimes I want that background to be a little softer than what the camera renders, and the lens blur tool, and then being able to just be able to fine tune that. I haven't had to, once you play with that little depth graph they give you, right?
Right.
Once I kind of get that the way that I want, I have actually haven't had to fool around much with the mask from there.
I agree. And I think that's also that those brush refinements within the lens blur tool, I think they've benefited from that same subject detection. I've had a couple where I remember doing a demo and it was a bird in a tree. So there's branches in front of the bird and behind it, and using the brush to make sure, okay, this is out of focus, this is in focus, and it just does such a great job selecting those different pieces.
Criminal, I tell you.
I know.
So what else is going on with Lightroom that you've been kind of jazzed about?
I'm a little bit over the generative AI stuff, and it seems like a discussion that we being photographers have every other day. That said, some of the AI remove tools in Lightroom have really gotten pretty darn good. One of the announcements yesterday was the generative expand. So they've had that in Photoshop for a while. So now we can not just crop into a picture, we can crop out, and then Lightroom will theoretically draw in basically what's on the edges. So, which is great if you've got, I think we all have some photo or another, some wildlife that we just had to grab the shot and didn't get the composition exactly like we want. It's too close to one of the edges. That kind of thing can really make or break a photo sometimes. So I think
I
that'll
would
be
have loved
interesting.
to have that tool when I was shooting magazine covers
Oh,
because,
yeah.
because a lot of times you'll have a great shot and there just isn't enough room at the top for the type. And
Yep.
oh man, if I could have
I
had that
know.
generative AI then, oh my gosh.
For real. And there's a couple of things, and I think that's one of the tools that I would mostly use for commercial work. I don't use a lot of generative tools for my personal work, for my wildlife photography, travel photography. It's not really a, philosophical thing as much as that's just not the kind of pictures that I make. But I can't always choose what time of day I go photograph a house, or what's, I can't always wait for the perfect weather. So I've got to know how to fix those things for money. You know what I mean? So these kinds of tools are really wonderful for that.
Well, when I like them is, I do all event photography, my kind of bag. And I just love it for stray people. I mean, honestly, when I'm shooting out in public, you can't go up to people and say, "Hey, buddy, can you get your kids and your dog out of my shot?" I mean,
Right.
that's not very polite, and I would never do that. So, and these days I don't worry about it. Mainly I look for overlap while I'm composing and just know, I don't want any overlap with my main subject that would be difficult to take out later on. But it really has kind of relieved the stress for me, when I'm doing event work and don't have to worry about those odd little stray things that just happen sometimes.
Yeah, it definitely helps. The tools that I'm hoping come to Lightroom before too long, the mask that I would like to have would be Select Windows.
Yeah, that would be good.
that would be huge for real estate photographers,
I
because
bet. Oh my gosh.
you can use, some, and it's one of those tools that sometimes it works wonderfully and sometimes it's just terrible. I can use object selection and select a whole window, and sometimes it'll select the entire window, including the frame. Sometimes it only selects in the pane where you want it to select. There's no consistency really in that use case. And it would be awesome if one of the landscape, one of the AI tools was select windows. Like,
I know.
ding.
That's
That
been
would be
kind of my
great.
experience with the anti-reflection tool or the reflection correction tool or whatever. It has
Yeah.
really been hit or miss. Now, I heard that they improved it a bit. I haven't tested it since I heard
I
that,
haven't either, and I
but
haven't I've yet to use that tool that it did what I hoped it would do.
it was same
So
here. I keep hoping though.
I know I remember the first time I used the generative remove. It was actually on a real estate image. It was this backyard, and they had this kind of a gazebo, but it was a screened porch. It was floating in the middle of their backyard, and I didn't realize until I got the picture home, they had all their pool toys stacked up about 4 feet high in this screened room. So of course, there they are. I
There
totally dropped the ball there. And I was like, well, let's see what generative remove will do. And I just selected the area where the
are.
pool toys were. And man, it you could see the woods but through the screen.
That's
It
crazy.
was a hundred absolutely perfect. And on the same house, I had there was a master bedroom or master bathroom, the primary bath, with this intricate tiled floor, and there was this ugly bath mat. And I said, well, let me just see what it'll do. And I selected the bath mat, and it matched the pattern of the tile floor.
Oof.
So when it works, it
It's
is unbelievable.
yeah.
But I've had just as many times where it just made me laugh. It was so bad. Like, what? No, of course
It's a
that's not what I want.
finger crossed situation. Hey, I wanted to mention back on the people thing too, because this actually came up in our last workshop. So when you do people select, right, and you're working, and it's going to select what it sees and all that, you can decide which people stay and which people don't. You have that control. I
That's right.
think some people sometimes don't realize that you can, click on it and say, no, not keep this person, that one goes.
That's right. You can adjust. And to the same tune, if you're using the generative remove tool, you can actually go in and paint. You can select one thing and then you can add to that selection. You can add and so you can refine that selection. If it sometimes it'll pick up something, next to what you're trying to remove that you don't need it to redraw. And you can definitely go in and adjust that.
So you have an advanced class coming up on September 9th, or intermediate. We did sort of the introduction overview earlier this year. So tell us what's going to go on now starting September 9th, because I think a lot of people, and we have a lot of signups already, they're pretty jazzed about being more of a power tools kind of mode here.
Right. And that's what I'm going to focus on is the things like the tools that we've been talking about, right? The tools that I use as a working photographer every day. A lot of the masking, a lot of the where the rubber meets the road is obviously in the develop module. It's wild to me, just this year in workshops, I've seen things that I consider basic parts of Lightroom and sort of basic, tools that everyone, I think surely everyone knows how to use this tool, like the camera profiles. It was eye-opening to me how many clients that I've had say, well, I don't have there's they don't have profiles for my camera in Lightroom. Because if they click on the little drop-down menu, they don't see the profiles, but they don't understand that there's a whole menu of profiles that go with their camera, and there's different creative options, and you can even add to that list. You can make your own profiles. So that's a huge thing with raw files that I think some people maybe don't understand. So I'm definitely going to touch on things like that. I've watched people using Lightroom as far as the import process and just their basic organization tools. And I want to talk about that and make sure everybody understands how that works. I've seen some wild workflows where people are going around their butt to reach their elbow, as my grandmother would say, to where, oh, why don't you just click A to B? And they go, well, I use this other software to do this, and then I do this with Lightroom. And so I think there's just a basic understanding of how the import works and why that is really helpful. And it's one of the things that I like about the software, as a matter of fact. So I want to make sure that we're all on the same page, we're all getting off on the right foot, and then we're making our images look amazing.
Hey, I want to go back to profiles for a moment, because it was pretty dramatic the difference they made in Costa Rica when you were doing the red-eye tree frogs, and how I think out of the can, what we had, we were getting more of an orange, weren't we?
Yes. What we learned was that so with the red-eyed tree frogs, they literally have red eyes. They are just bright red eyes, and they have orange feet. And none of the Adobe profiles, I don't think anyone, no matter what camera they were using, all of the Adobe profiles translated the red in the eyes and the orange in the feet as basically the same color. It didn't think there was a difference at all. And it was striking because we had all seen these animals and we're like, no, that's red and that's orange. And I have a calibrated profile for my Sony A7R6 that I made with the color checker, with the Calibrate color checker. When I turn that on, oh, lo and behold, the eye's red and the feet are orange. And it's a striking difference between that and the basic Adobe profiles. Like you said, that was an eye-opener for a lot of people. Well, I've been using these Adobe profiles and I might not be getting the color that I could be getting.
Well, the thing that I was thinking about when I was looking at the shots and the changes and the difference between them was that this is something that could just save you a whole lot of editing time because you could go down the rabbit hole of trying to make those feet orange by doing masking and doing brushing and all that. And
That's right.
this is like a case where a global adjustment literally changed the shot.
That's right. And it's really just a matter of telling the software how to read the data in the raw file. That's what it is. It's just saying, well, okay, if you see this one and this zero, then it means this color. It's just the basic, just the ground floor of your editing. I have a picture of three scarlet macaws flying, and it was in the light at sunrise. And all I did was change to my calibrated profile. And just like you said, I didn't edit the picture at all. It looked like it was kind of the color was a little flat and the red wasn't really bright and it just didn't have a lot of pop. And then I just changed to the calibrated profile so that the raw file was being read as it should have been. Done. And I literally didn't edit it any more than that. So that's a great point.
This is the kind of stuff that's going to be in the workshop. And I think a lot of times people think on an advanced workshop that, that it's going to be hard, But
Right.
actually, a lot of things that you're going to show them is actually going to make their editing easier,
That's
because
exactly
of
right.
exactly what we're talking about.
That is 100% true because the things in this class come from, I use this tool all the time. This tool set all the time. And it's for me looking over people's shoulder and saying, "Wow, they're doing it this hard way, and I could just show you the easy way to do it." The more advanced way is often quite a bit easier because I don't have time to spend, 45 minutes editing a picture. I need the way to get it to where I want it, and I need to do that fast, right?
I mean, no one wants to be editing little frog feet. I mean,
I think we might have some clients that would actually like to do
Well,
that.
maybe I don't. I'm not one
Yeah,
of
some people like editing
them.
way more than I like to, and I like it.
Anything else before this has been great, by the way. Anything else before we wrap up here?
I'm excited about the class. I'm excited to do all these things again. I do it all the time, and to really break it down and say, okay, it's you do this and then you do that, and here's why. I love teaching and especially things that I'm so familiar with. So I'm excited to help everybody get their editing supercharged.
Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it too, and looking forward to it. All right, my friend. Well, I need to let you get back to work, but I've really enjoyed this conversation and looking forward to the class.
Me too, man. Good to see you.
All right, take care. Thank you so much, Rob. Looking forward to your class. As always, great to sit down with you and talk shop. I have a couple things I want to cover on our camera news of the week. And the first thing I want to talk about is, and this is interesting to me, Fujifilm says the quiet part out loud, the memory crisis is coming for cameras. And this is an article that is on petapixel.com. I have a link in the show notes. While Petapixel already covered the big picture information from Fujifilm's latest financial results, including the company's imaging business is a huge moneymaker, there's another part of the company's results well worth discussing, the impact of increased memory prices on expected operational costs and what Fujifilm plans to do about it. Fujifilm mentioned the impact of rising raw material prices when discussing its revenue and operating income for the first quarter of the fiscal year ending March 31st, 2027. However, the company's full presentation offers more detail about what that actually means. Compared to its previous forecast for this fiscal year, released on May 12, 2026, Fujifilm has significantly revised its cost projections. While Fujifilm's operating income projections have not wavered from the 365 billion yen across all segments for the entire fiscal year, precisely how the company will get there has changed quite a bit. Fujifilm has increased its forecasted memory price cost projection by 14 billion yen, that's nearly $88 million, for the fiscal year, and the imaging division alone accounts for 8 billion yen, just over 50 million, of that cost revision. While much ink has been spilled about the memory crisis, especially as it relates to memory card and storage products, its impact has not yet been particularly felt in the camera space, but it will be. Cameras rely on these same chips that are exorbitantly pricier today than they were last year, thanks mostly to AI data centers. Fujifilm's cost breakdown offers unique insight into potential reckoning in the digital camera space, but make no mistake, increased memory prices will affect everyone, not just Fujifilm. There are still many unknowns, but when every camera company is expressing the same concern, and Fujifilm specifically says it expects to spend an extra $50 million to source memory components for its imaging products this year, there's plenty of reason to worry. And there's a whole bunch more information in this article in the middle. I have the link in the show notes and you can read it. But the fact of the matter is that, in addition to everything else that's going on in terms of inflation, tariffs, all that stuff, it looks like that these memory prices are also going to begin to kick in, and we'll probably start seeing some pressure in the marketplace later this year and early in 2027. The times we live in, right? The second article I want to talk about has to do with the upcoming solar eclipse. That's right. We have a big solar eclipse coming. And there's just a little reminder here, and this is sponsored content from KNF Concept, but it's good stuff, and it is on digitalcameraworld.com. I'm just going to read you a little bit. As you know, the link is in the show notes, and you can read the rest on your own. Don't destroy your camera. If you want to photograph the eclipse in August, you need a solar eclipse filter. Photographers across the UK and Europe will be pointing their lenses at the sky as a spectacular solar eclipse is due to occur on August 12th. However, if you don't properly protect your equipment, trying to shoot this event could be completely destroying your camera. You might remember playing with a magnifying glass during summers as a kid, focusing the sunlight into a concentrated point and burning holes in paper or leaves. Well, when you point your camera at the sun, your lens is acting like a giant magnifying glass, except this time the concentrated point of sunlight is going to burn holes in your shutter and image sensor. To prevent this damage to your camera components, it's absolutely essential that you use a neutral density filter on your lens, but not your regular 2 or 6-stop filter that you use for landscapes. You need a purpose-built solar filter with as much as 20-stop power. And you need to ensure that it's from a brand you trust. Here we go. As a cheap filter from an unknown company can leave you with a repair bill in the thousands, if not having to replace your camera altogether. So then it gets into the KNF Concept filter. By the way, KNF Concept is a filter company I really like. I just think their filters are really nice. So this is a good piece. The eclipse is coming up. For those of you listening on Tuesday, it's going to be on Wednesday. Obviously, if you're going to photograph it, you're already prepared to do that. This is more for those that maybe haven't prepared and thinking about doing a little something on the fly. Don't. Don't do it on the fly. Not unless you're protecting your camera and your eyes. For our Virtual Camera Club news, I want to start out by thanking our Inner Circle members. These are the folks that support our podcast and our community month in and month out. If you're interested in becoming an Inner Circle member, just go to thedigitalstory.com, click on the Patreon tile that's on every page. You can sign up there, and the next thing you know, you'll be hearing from me with access to our exclusive Inner Circle site, discounts for upcoming workshops, and more. And a big thanks to our Inner Circle members for supporting this community. Also want to mention our good friends at Red River Paper, longest running sponsor of the Digital Story. You know, we're talking about Lightroom today. And one of the things that I think Lightroom does very well is its print module. I think the print module is really fantastic. And if you take a little time to really learn how it works and all the different things that you can do in that print module, for example, just as one top of mind thing that I really like about it, where you can float an image in a big piece of paper. Let's say that you have 11 by 14 inch piece of Red River paper, and you want to float an image in it to have a nice big white area all the way around it. Lightroom makes that very easy to do. You can really do all sorts of cool stuff like that. Now, of course, the advantage is that if your image is floated in this very nice big white space, put it in a beautiful black frame, you don't need to get a mat for that. You can just put it right in there. And especially when you're printing your own stuff and you're changing it out in frames, you don't want to have to get a custom mat every time. This allows you to crop the image exactly the way that you want. You don't have to worry about fitting within a mat or anything like that. Go ahead and crop the image the way that looks best to your eye. And then in the print module in Lightroom, go ahead and float it in that nice white space of Red River paper. You don't need the mat, put it in a frame, and it looks beautiful. There's a lot of creative things that you can do on the print side. And if you haven't spent much time in Lightroom's print module, I suggest you take a look at it because it can be really cool. And especially for people who like to print a lot, change out their frames, all that good kind of stuff, it's really handy. And of course, there's all sorts of additional tips on Red River Paper site. All you have to do is click on the Red River Paper tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. Find a few articles, start printing, make sure you have some Red River Paper, and then off to the races you go. A big thanks to Red River Paper for sponsoring this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show. Working on more great stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.